the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Take Two. I'm Libby Denkman, in for A. Martinez. Budget battles are happening on the state level and here in L.A., with many protesting proposed cuts to programs serving the most vulnerable. Plus, Attorney General Javier Becerra is fighting the Trump administration's rollback of auto emission standards.
This is 2020, not 1920. We just can't go back to those days.
All that ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Libby Denkman, in for A. Martinez today. Thank you for joining us. It's been a big news day, so we'll aim to get to many of the big stories, including protests in Los Angeles over the death of George Floyd, and so many other issues being compounded by this pandemic. Plus, city officials are calling on Councilman Jose Huizar to resign. We'll catch you up on that story in about 30 minutes. But let's start today with State of Affairs, our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. This week, though, coronavirus cases continue to rise. Governor Newsom moves to rapidly reopen California. Are his decisions based on science or politics? Meanwhile, the state Senate plans to push back on Newsom's budget cuts. Their message appears to be spend more, borrow more. We'll get into those stories and more with Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Hi, Carla. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Libby. Good to be with you.
Also with us is Zach Corser. He co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Welcome to you, Zach.
Great to be here, Libby.
Carla, we'll start with you. The messaging that we have received from Governor Newsom in recent weeks seems to put the focus on slow and methodical reopening. But this week, Newsom and some officials down here surprised a lot of people by speeding up the process. And this morning, LA County got permission to allow hair salons and restaurants to reopen, even though we still have a huge number of coronavirus cases. What's been the general reaction to this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Gavin Newsom got that high praise and marks at the start of this pandemic for sticking with the data, for relying on the medical community, and for those early shutdowns. But now, Libby, we're seeing the effects of 2 months of lockdowns and public pressure, and there's been a lot of political pressure on him to open up, local officials, retailers, church leaders, and so forth. So Newsom's reopening plan started about 2 weeks ago with a handful of rural counties and relatively few cases, you know, allowing restaurant dining and shopping and so forth. But as you said, now we're going into phase three, reopening churches, malls, hair salons, and he's talking about gyms and schools within a week or so. And that reopening strategy, some critics say, is too rapid, and they're fearing that the governor is basing his decisions more on political pressure than on science. I spoke to Steve Glazer, the state senator from the East Bay here, and he's a moderate pro-business Democrat, and he said that the governor still hasn't managed to come up with that widespread testing that's going to provide the necessary information to attack the virus on all fronts. The big issue here is they're worrying that the state reopens too fast, and California pushes too hard now, a very dark fall may be coming with a resurgence, almost certain, and that may require more reclosures, more quarantine, and that is a very tough genie to put back in the bottle once people are used to their freedom again, Libby.
Yeah, when you lose the moderate Democrats in that way, I mean, that speaks volumes. And I know Santa Clara County Public Health Officer Sarah Cody says we're moving too fast. That was an area with a really early hot spot as well. Zach Corser, as Carla mentioned, you know, even the architect of the country's first regional lockdown order, you know, has concerns about what's going on. But it's also hard to forget that reopening has become, as she mentioned, a hot button political issue. To what extent do you think that Newsom's accelerated reopening is based on a political calculation?
Well, I mean, I agree that with Carla that, you know, the idea is that this has gone on a while now, and it's political, definitely. But I don't think it's political in a sort of, you know, party political sense of, you know, Republicans and Democrats and a sort of, you know, the sort of national tone that we're getting around the country about, you know, the wearing of masks and how quickly we're moving. I think what we're seeing here is the limits to the enforcement of these orders. I think, and it's not my opinion, but how I'm reading the political tea leaves and what I'm seeing around my community and around Los Angeles County I think, you know, if without wide public acceptance of the need for these closures, I think there's real limits to the governor's ability to enforce those limits. And so, you know, in order to maintain his authority, in order to maintain the legitimacy of what the governor is saying and how he's directing events, I think he's got to show a little bit of give on how we're going to move forward cautiously. But I think he's got to show a bit of give, because I think a lot of the state, even in, you know, the bluer areas of the state, Los Angeles County, you know, they are the ones who put in a request for opening up restaurants. I mean, that's a pretty bold move if you truly think that cases are accelerating here. But again, I think it's just a sort of recognition that politically, if the people are not behind you, that there are real limits to your authority and your ability to enforce this. So either you've got to move a little bit in that direction, or you've got to risk that people are going to stop paying attention.
Mm. Carla, for those who watched Newsom unveil his revised budget, when we talk about how this coronavirus has affected public sector finances and local and national government budgets, when he revealed that budget earlier this month, he made it pretty clear that the state will face even greater pain without some federal assistance. Republican leaders like Mitch McConnell have been reluctant to consider more aid to state and local without really large concessions from Democrats. What's the calculation here from Newsom? Is he thinking maybe that moving along faster with reopening might help his case with Republicans in the Senate in order to get some of that local aid?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think this is a political calculation, as you said. I mean, he is walking a tightrope here. I mean, here in California, I spoke to Republican Assemblyman Jordan Cunningham of San Luis Obispo not long ago, and he dramatizes the concerns of many Republicans who say that from the business point of view, they are really worried. Cunningham told me he's getting hundreds of calls every week from Main Street businesses who he's concerned they're dying, you know, as we speak. And Tulare County, another area, conservative area, that has been pressuring to open. So Republicans have been outspoken. And by the way, they're increasingly outspoken on his budget, too. They're looking at some of his expenditures, like on projects like high-speed rail, and saying, hey, those should go first, maybe before education cuts or other things. And I think Newsom is going to feel face pressure from Democrats, too, Libby, on this budget. But they're resisting cuts to schools and Medi-Cal for undocumented seniors. So, yes, this is all tied in with the budget. And it's all tied in with the economic health of California. And this is the big challenge that Gavin Newsom faces as we go into these new phases of this pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, that's something we're facing on the city level here in Los Angeles and the county level when community leaders are pushing for a reimagining of how we allocate spending during this pandemic, when the mayor here has introduced a really austere budget because of the massive revenue shortfall. Zach, what do you think about the trade-offs here that Newsom is facing?
Well, again, there's not a lot of easy decisions to be made here, but you know, I don't know that it's all about the economy, this decision. It's a lot of it, of course, but there's a lot of strange signals out there. Today, for example, a statistic was released that the savings rate in America just hit a record of 33%, meaning last month in April, actually 2 months ago in April, Americans put over a third of their income into savings that month. That's up from less than 10. There's a lot of unemployment continuing to rise. But I think there's a sense that it's time to reopen, that you know, people are ready to get back to work, that a lot of the stimulus has had a positive effect in terms of keeping people employed, keeping paychecks going. I don't know what it's going to look like. We'll probably talk more about this when we start talking specifically about, you know, the parts of the California budget that the legislature is talking about in terms of, you know, their differences from Newsom. But I'm pretty sure that, you know, there's not going to be as big a stimulus package coming out of Washington, D.C. And I think, you know, part of the calculation is not only this sort of, you know, recognition that people have this feeling that this will be over soon and they're very anxious and waiting for that kind of result, but I think also that, you know, we've got to get the economy moving again. That's sort of a feeling, and that if we don't do it now, there could be future catastrophic economic consequences. I think that is definitely in the back of everyone's mind.
Mm-hmm. Like if this moves into the real estate and we see mortgage defaults, things like that. I mean, there are ways that this ripple effect could really stay with us for a long time. This is State of Affairs. I'm Libby Denkman in for A. Martinez today on Take Two. Claremont McKenna's Zach Courser and Politico's Carla Marinucci are with me. And Carla, back to the budget and like Zach mentioned, getting a little bit more specific. Newsom's cuts have been called draconian by Democratic state senators as they've been pushing back on these cuts, and they have proposed another budget plan that rolls back many of the reductions. What are the biggest differences that you see in the proposals?
Yeah, I mean, the Democratic pushback came right away with the governor's proposal for a $14 billion cut in state spending, most of that from schools. The Senate Budget Committee this week voted to refuse Newsom's efforts to suspend Medi-Cal optional benefits and to extend Medi-Cal insurance to undocumented older adults. And that's something the governor embraced in his January budget blueprint. I mean, Newsom has said those cuts could be avoided if the federal government comes through with the coronavirus assistance package by early July. And let's face it, he may get some help from Nancy Pelosi on that front. But it looks like the California Senate doesn't want to take any chances. They've put forward a plan that avoid his cuts basically by relying on deferrals and dipping deeper into California's rainy day fund. And they are vowing to channel more money to schools in the current fiscal year, whether or not Congress comes through. So this is going to be a battle, Libby. We'll see how this plays out. And as Zach said, there's no good answers here.
Yeah. And dipping into that rainy day fund, I mean, you know, spending down your reserves can hurt your credit rating and your ability to borrow money in the future. There are trade-offs in everything that you do when it comes to budget shortfalls. San Jose Senator Jim Beal said that the Democratic plan has more empathy than the one put forward by Newsom. But of course, there are other issues with it. You know, are we going to get federal aid? Are we going to tap those reserves, which can affect your credit rating? What do you make of the proposal?
Well, we talked a couple of weeks ago when Newsom released his budget that, you know, at long last, the California legislature is back in session. And we've sort of maybe gotten used to executive orders and sort of governing by emergency decree because of the pandemic. But, now that we're into the budget and that the legislature has its say, and we're on a pretty short timeline, you know, they've got to come up with a decision by June 15th. You know, I think some of this is driven by the fact that the legislature is asserting itself and saying, you know, we're here too. We're a co-equal branch of government, and we have our own opinions about this. I do think that, you know, strategically two things stuck out to me. One is their willingness to borrow, something that Newsom wasn't really interested in doing. But basically, I think the strategy really works out to where Newsom was seeing this as being, a federal package should come into view by July, and we will wait for cuts until then. You know, the legislature hasn't said we won't need cuts. Basically, they've pushed the timeline all the way to the end of September and say that cuts would come October 1st if the federal government didn't act. So they've extended the playtime and, you know, the on the board, so to speak, for the feds to work out some kind of deal. But it doesn't, you know, they haven't eliminated the cuts. I think they've just stretched the period of time in which we can stave those cuts off.
You know, I was sitting in on an LA City Council meeting earlier this week, and the council members were asking the budget analysts about lobbyists for the city in D.C. and whether they expected the HEROES Act with $1 trillion for local and state aid that passed through the Democratic-controlled House, whether that was going to have a chance in the Senate. And the lobbyists really thought no. And it wasn't something that the council members wanted to hear, because if that money is not coming, there is going to be further cuts at all levels of local government. Last topic today, because it has, as many times when the president tweets, it has taken over the news cycle. Zach, President Trump went head to head with Silicon Valley this week after Twitter fact checked a tweet about voting by mail, and he signed an executive order aimed at this law that protects tech companies. And constitutional law experts already have concerns about the order. And as I understand it, Zach, forcing companies to police posts more could actually affect the president himself. We have just a little bit of time here, but can you kind of break down your perspective on this?
Sure. Just very quickly, what will happen here is that the internet regulation the United States has had since the 1990s has been a very low regulation environment that tries to take responsibility away from platforms, providers for moderating content. We've really tried to make this as open as possible in terms of speech. If President Trump is going to start introducing a regulatory environment where the federal government will be, you know, weighing in and forcing companies to regulate their content, companies are going to be very risk averse to doing that. So either they're going to stop offering these services or they're going to start offering them in a much more moderated kind of way that will make it very difficult for, say, a President Trump to say whatever they want on Twitter.
Yeah.
It's not a public utility. And if the federal government wants to step in to regulate it, they're going to step back.
That's Zach Corser, who co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. And Carla Marinucci also joined us today, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Have a safe weekend, and thank you so much, both of you.
You too.
Thanks, Libby.
Over the next several days, we will be hearing from high school students. Sheltering at home hasn't been easy, especially for seniors. It's meant having to miss out on traditions leading up to graduation, while still making sure to buckle down and adjust to online learning. In the next couple of weeks, it will also mean having to graduate virtually. Julian Jacobson is a high school senior and baseball player at Palisades Charter High School in Los Angeles. Here's his story.
Learning from home has definitely been a struggle. I've definitely not learned as much as I would in class, but as a result of the current situation, I've definitely learned a lot more things about myself and about the world and about how life really works. Socially, not seeing my fellow teammates, coaches, teachers, and friends that I'm used to seeing every day, not seeing them for months on end has definitely been a challenge, but I'm very grateful for the technology that we're blessed with, the types of communication that we can all have, and just knowing that we're all going to be stronger on the other side of this and hopefully be able to see each other soon enough, that's definitely pushing me forward. Knowing that I won't have a normal standard graduation that pretty much everyone I know outside of my age has had is definitely unfortunate to not be able to walk out on our football field and hear my name walk across the stage and be able to throw my cap in the air and do that with all my best friends and teammates and have all my loved ones in the stands. But on the flip side of that, there are definitely more hardships that we've had to go through during this time. And if missing a graduation is the worst of all, then I consider myself very lucky. My plan is to go to Johnson & Wales University in Providence, Rhode Island. I plan to study sports management there and minor in culinary arts. I'm looking for a sense of culture change, and I think on the East Coast, Providence, Rhode Island is a perfect place to experience that. For me, the silver lining has been that I've become well more aware of how precious and special the people are to me and around my life. I am forever grateful for the coaches, teachers, friends, teammates, and family that I have. And this whole experience with the quarantine and the coronavirus has made me very aware of that.
That was Julian Jacobson, a high school senior and baseball player at Palisades Charter High School in Los Angeles. Well, the anger over the death of George Floyd in Minnesota has spilled over into the streets of L.A., but protests have highlighted community frustration over so much more. We'll dig into all the issues after the break.
Far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah, Father, Father.
back now with Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm reporter Libby Denkman, sitting in for A. Martinez today. Protests continue in Minneapolis and across the country over the death of George Floyd. The 46-year-old died after police handcuffed and restrained him on Monday. Prosecutors have arrested one officer, Derek Chauvin, and filed third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter charges against him. Chauvin was captured on video using his knee to pin Floyd down for nearly 9 minutes until Floyd became unresponsive and was later pronounced dead at a local hospital. Chauvin and three other officers involved in the incident were fired by the Minneapolis Police Department earlier this week. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, groups including Black Lives Matter LA took to the streets for a second time last night. The anger fueling demonstrations against police violence is also uniting activists who are fighting to change how money is spent at City Hall. And one of the leaders in that movement is Pastor Stephen Q. John Mowee of the Church Without Walls in Skid Row. When I reached him today, he began with the protests happening in Minneapolis, LA, and elsewhere.
Well, America woke up to black rage, right? Black rage is something that our society has been dealing with for a long time. In the summer of 1967, there were over 160, they say riots, we say rebellions, because our people have always rebelled against a system that continues to oppress them. And so there were 163 rebellions in America. They called it the hot summer of 1967. So those who are aware knows that this can get worse. And though many of us don't condone violence, but many times when people see protests, they always see the violence as the acts that are being committed by folks who are protesting, but never see the violence, the initial violence that was committed by the officer. And generally, when you think about protests in this country and black rage and black rebellion, police brutality has always been the spark that ignited this type of situation.
And I want to get to the issue that you and other groups are talking about, really reevaluating the way funding is allocated in the city. Just briefly, what is it about this moment that is inspiring so much action, people taking to the streets, and we're seeing many groups across the country getting involved? We haven't seen anything like this since Ferguson, Missouri, after Mike Brown was killed. What is happening in this moment to inspire a similar reaction?
Well, to be clear, groups of us have been organizing. In fact, George Floyd happened in the midst of us of organizing, right? Ahmaud Arbery happened in the midst of us organizing. We were already organizing around this budget. We were already organizing around VA Jackie Lacey. We've been protesting Jackie Lacey for a couple of years now. We've been at the police commission for a couple of years now. We were instrumental in helping pass Prop 47. And when we passed, when the community groups worked together and band together to pass that, now for the past couple of years, we're seeing a decrease in crime, and LAPD wants to take credit for that. Law enforcement as a whole wants to take credit for that. But they said when we were working on Prop 47, that Prop 47 would increase crime. That didn't happen. Crime decreased, I think, at its lowest level since 1962, right? And so this work has been going on for years. And we, George Floyd, yes, it sparks an opportunity and it gives us more energy and it gives us more of a boost. But this is work we've been doing, the work that behind the scenes that we've been doing for years. So we were in the midst of this fight when George Floyd was murdered, and all it does is really highlight the issues that we are and legitimize again. Once again, our issues have always been legitimate, but it legitimizes it for the dominant culture, those in the dominant culture who couldn't see it.
I'm talking with Pastor Stephen Q. John Maui of the Church Without Walls in Skid Row, and we're discussing the demonstrations following the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, in Los Angeles, and nationwide, and also this effort that I've been reporting on for LAist and that Pastor John Maui has been helping to lead to get the city to rethink how it's spending money now that it's budget-making season and there are a lot of cuts on the table ahead for the city funding plan. And Pastor John Maui, the mayor last month introduced a city budget that cuts $230 million and includes service reductions and civilian worker furloughs in the next fiscal year. That plan is set to take effect July 1st. But you and this coalition of community groups that's led by Black Lives Matter are calling for something called the People's Budget. What changes are you proposing and why?
Well, first of all, we know that the mayor's budget cuts all services across the board, but yet still gives LAPD a raise. And we left our people on Skid Row to die. When we said we had hotel rooms for them, we did not respond until a couple weeks after the pandemic. If COVID-19 was a virus that was more contagious and would kill people on the spot, and we know that's possible now, many of the people on Skid Row would be gone now. And many of the houseless people in the city would be gone. So the city doesn't have a plan. We don't have housing for folks. Yes, still, we're cutting from those line items, and we're giving LAPD a raise. It's mind-boggling to me.
And I spoke to the LAPPL, the Los Angeles Police Protective League. That is the union that represents uniformed police officers. And they pointed out that their officers are taking on a growing range of tasks, assisting people during this pandemic who need shelter or mental health care, and that these were raises that they fairly negotiated last year. And other city workers also negotiated raises, although those city workers are subject to furloughs. Well, the Los Angeles Police Department is not. What's your response to this idea that the police are simply too vital to be subject to furloughs or to the cuts that are facing other city departments?
My question is, are nurses not vital? They were on the front line. Nurses were literally dying. How many LAPD officers died of COVID-19? And so everyone is making a sacrifice in this time. And to furlough other organizations and other parts of our city and other services and not furloughing LAPD, that is wrong. And secondly, you can see by what's happening right now in Minneapolis, you can see by what happened in 1992, that in the Black community, Black and brown communities, police cannot be our social workers. They can't be our counselor. We have a history. And in order for America to show Black folks that you love us, you're going to have to understand our pain, help us deal with our trauma. If not, we're going to deal with our trauma on our own.
What's next for the movement? I look at what's happening over the George Floyd killing in Minneapolis, and I see demonstrations here in Los Angeles also connecting that issue to spending on the Los Angeles Police Department, as we've discussed, and this alternative plan, the People's Budget. Where does this movement go in the coming days and weeks? And what is planned right now in terms of demonstrations in the city of Los Angeles?
I can't say outright what is planned for demonstration because that would be counterproductive to our strategies. But we know that we've got to keep the issue at the forefront because we've been fighting this fight for a long time, right? This fight did not begin with Black Lives Matter. This fight has been going on for a long time. We are standing on the shoulders of our ancestors who've been fighting this fight for quite a while. And we know that we need to bring the resources that we need to our communities. We need to build our communities. We need to deal with capitalism. We need an alternative to capitalism for our community. Presidents are not going to fix it. We are organizing as communities. We need to create alternatives in our communities. We have ideas of what those things are, right, that I don't want to repeat now, but we have ideas of what those alternatives are in our communities that can make a more vibrant community. And the reality is we don't want to focus on law enforcement as our way of building our community. We want to build, we need better schools. We need, there are all kinds of resources we need in our community, but we need to dismantle this system and build a new system. We need to envision a new system. We need to reimagine public safety. And as a community, that's what the Black community has been doing. That's what some of our folks in the Brown community have been doing. And in the Indigenous communities have been doing. And we have been reimagining public safety. And it, it doesn't look like the system that we have now. It is a better system. It is a system where we can have workers that are working. Who, we don't need people with guns to go and deal with homeless people or with people who are mentally ill. That's not the first people they should have, they should encounter. They should encounter a professional who has the skills and the ability to know how to de-escalate and do that type of work. So there are a lot of areas that we need to shore up in our society.
And Pastor, I thank you so much. We are just running up against time, but I do thank you for joining us today on Take Two. Pastor Stephen Q. John Maui of the Church Without Walls on Skid Row, and he's one of the leaders who has been out protesting in the wake of the George Floyd killing in Minneapolis here in Los Angeles. Thank you, Pastor, very much for joining us on KPCC.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me. It is a pleasure.
This morning, we went out to talk to Angelenos about what's been happening with George Floyd's death and the pandemic and all the inequities that have been exposed by these events. Here's Tony Banks and Joelle Earle.
System is rigged against you, so therefore, you're not going to get no justice in the courtroom. So the only thing you do have is violence. America always pulled through, but it's going to pull through for a select few, and for the others, it's going to be shit.
You see people kind of living with the coronavirus, knowing that it's here to stay, it's something that you're going to have to get used to, and that's why you see the news focus. Now it's, you're starting to hear about other things going on in the world, and it's like, now we remember that the world is messed up. It always was that way. It's just now you're hearing about it again as life is somewhat returning to normal.
You just heard Tony Banks and Joelle Earle. We ran into them near the hot dog spot Earle's on Crenshaw that Joelle co-owns. Well, all has been quiet from Councilman Jose Huizar's office as city officials call on him to resign. After a short break, we'll catch up on the federal investigation into corruption targeting him and everything else that got us to this point. Stick around for that. This is Take Two. I'm Libby Denkman in for A. Martinez.
Chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share.
You're back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for A. Martinez. Another domino dropped this week in a sweeping corruption investigation at City Hall. A former top deputy to L.A. City Councilman Jose Huizar has agreed to plead guilty to a racketeering conspiracy charge. The FBI says he played a central role in a criminal organization focused on real estate development in downtown L.A. The U.S. Attorney's Office says George Esparza, along with an unnamed city council member, took cash, gifts, trips, campaign donations, all sorts of perks in exchange for political favors. Joining us to talk about this mind-boggling case is John Rigardi. He's been writing about the investigation for Los Angeles Magazine's website, lamag.com. Thanks for being on the show today, John.
Thank you, Libby.
So this story has been unfolding for months. We've both been covering it, really years now that the investigation started way back several years ago. And with Esparza's guilty plea, that makes a total of four men admitting that they were part of this pay-to-play scheme. I want to get to the big picture in a moment, but first, what has Esparza admitted to, and what was his role at City Hall?
Well, Esparza, who's 33, he spent 5 years as a special assistant to Councilman Huizar, a sort of fixer who we've learned now, you know, worked a lot with him on development projects. Now, he's been charged with one count of conspiring to violate the RICO statute. That's really big. That's the statute used to go against mobsters and organized crime. And it's very significant because, A, he faces up to 20 years, and B, he is acknowledged literally being part of what prosecutors say is a criminal enterprise operating within City Hall, one so big that they actually refer to it as the Council District A enterprise.
And Huizar, to be clear, has not been charged or even named in these documents, right? Why do we know? What are the details that have led us to understand that indeed this is Jose Huizar at the center of this?
Correct. He's never been named and he's not been charged. It's almost like the federal authorities are playing, sort of having fun at doing everything they can just to hint at who they're talking about. You know, they note Council Member A's role as the chair of the Planning and Land Use Management Committee. Well, Council Member Huizar chaired that committee. They mentioned in the new documents the council member settling a sexual harassment lawsuit in 2014, which was when Council Member Huizar was settling exactly that kind of lawsuit. They mentioned the council member's relative, who they refer to as relative A1, seeking to run for his seat. Well, Councilmember Huizar's wife, Rochelle Huizar, in September 2018, launched a campaign to run for his seat and then dropped out 2 months later after the infamous FBI raids.
I just want to make that clear because I know we are very careful as journalists to never name somebody who has not been, implicated beyond a shadow of a doubt in a situation like this. But all of Jose Huizar's colleagues and the mayor, the council president, they have all acknowledged that he is indeed the person that the FBI has been circling around for years now. And this has centered on the Plum Committee, a very powerful body in city politics. You mentioned that Jose Huizar chaired that committee. So what are we talking about here? What was the sort of thing that would be exchanged, and what were developers expecting to get from Jose Huizar and others?
Break it down really simply, and the developers wanted the council members' help in getting projects through the city approvals channel. And that's important because getting a project approved in LA, it's difficult. It's Byzantine. There's so many boxes to check and things to make happen. Specifically in the new Esparza documents, they detail a developer who's identified as the head of a Chinese company, literally paying more than $1 million in bribes to propel a 77-story tower getting built in downtown. Another case, which has been detailed in multiple documents, involved the developer paying $500,000, and this is where you saw things about $400,000 in cash in a bag, but that was being given to a council member to push a project that included allegedly needing the council member's help in knocking down a labor union's opposition to the project. Now, in that case, there was labor union opposition, and it did ultimately get knocked down. So, I mean, heck, in that case, you could almost say that the developer got what they paid for.
It was money well spent. I mean, they got it. They got the CEQA appeal dismissed, as you said. I mean, another gift that was revealed in this last Esparza plea deal, which was just totally astounding, was that a Chinese billionaire, right, put down collateral for a $600,000 loan that Councilman Huizar presumably didn't eventually need to pay back, right? What was that loan for?
That was for what we referred to earlier, settling the lawsuit. Councilmember Huizar, he did acknowledge having a extramarital relationship, which he had always said was consensual, with a former employee. Eventually, that seems to have soured, and she did accuse him of sexual harassment. There was a lawsuit. It was privately settled, so terms were never disclosed. City officials did take pains to note that no municipal money, no city money was involved in that payment. At the time, time, everyone was wondering, well, gosh, how did they settle it? What was the settlement? Did the council member on his own have that money? And now we found out that, yes, that that's what that $600,000 involved. And also in these documents, we found out that this same Chinese billionaire funded, you know, huge trips to more than a dozen trips to Las Vegas for council member A and Esparza. And as part of that, gave council member A $215,000 in casino chips.
Yeah, they sound like pretty amazing trips. You know, another trip that has really been a focus of the investigation was this one that Mitch Englander, the former council member for CD12, was on, along with John Lee, who's the current council member for CD12. And now we know that George Esparza was on that trip as well, June of 2017. Can you talk about how Mitch Englander was ensnared in this? What was he involved with? Because really the money that we're talking about with his case was much smaller than, it was small potatoes compared with the, what we presume is Huizar's gifts that were given to him.
Yeah, you know, and that's something that, you know, in certain ways people have almost been laughing about. You know, Councilmember Huizar allegedly, or excuse me, Councilmember A allegedly, you know, accepting hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. Mitch Englander, in the court documents that detailed his case, it was $15,000 handed over in cash, and the description of him benefiting from a different businessman who bankrolled this sort of epic night out in Las Vegas. There was a $2,500 dinner that was paid for. There was about $30,000 in terms of a bar bill that was paid for. You know,
bottle service. It was bottle service at a club. I mean, gosh, they were living large.
Oh, they, you know, someone must have been making it rain. I don't know, but... You know, you know, now Mitch Englander, you know, back in March, he did plead guilty to one count of scheming to falsify material facts. Now, essentially, that's related to, you know, obstructing a public corruption investigation. And, you know, I believe, if I remember right, you know, originally he was charged with seven counts and faced up to 15 years. After agreeing to plead guilty, and I think he's supposed to formally enter the plea next week, I believe he faces one count and up to 5 years in prison.
Yeah, John Rigardi, who writes for LAMag.com, one more question because we're almost out of time. And, you know, I laugh and I make light just because this is such an astounding set of allegations and confirmed wrongdoing now that the pleas are in. Why is Councilmember Jose Huizar still in office?
Yeah, and you know, you're right. And we do make light of this, but this is really serious. We're talking about the city's business. We're talking about trust within City Hall.
Taxpayer and the question, money, yeah.
Yeah, and the question you asked there is one that a lot of people are asking. You know, I wrote about this in a recent story for Los Angeles Magazine, and essentially the quick answer is it's complicated, but there's multiple reasons. One, he has actually not been charged with a crime, and there is the presumption of innocence, and while a lot of people have called for him to step down, the city charter does not allow you to just kick a elected official out of office unless there has been, you know, an indictment. There's also speculation that he hasn't stepped down because this job pays over $200,000 a year, and he presumably is going to need the money. Further, the longer he has this job, the longer he can potentially use it as a negotiating chip if he's talking with the feds.
Yeah, all of those things may be on the table. John Rigardi, it's been so fun talking with you about this case because I've been following it myself, and it is just, you know, sometimes I feel like, is this for real? It has just been so amazing to watch the level of corruption that has been admitted to so far at City Hall, and we'll be watching where this goes from here. John Rigardi, thank you so much. He writes for LAMag.com. That's where you can follow his coverage. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Libby.
Listen for more Take Two coming up next.
Like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
It's been too hard living.
You're back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman, in for A. Martinez. There's a battle in the air again over car emissions and how much of that stuff that comes out of our tailpipes can be released into the air. This week, California and 22 other states joined together in a lawsuit against the Trump administration. The case, that is, takes aim at the White House's rule released in March that rolled back fuel economy standards for vehicles. One of the leaders of that multi-state coalition is our state attorney general, Javier Becerra, who joins us now. Welcome.
Libby, thanks for having me.
So what the Trump administration did is set a lower goal for fuel economy compared to standards established under President Obama in 2012. So instead of about 50 miles per gallon by 2025, President Trump now says 40 miles per gallon is going to be okay. What's your issue with that from an environmental standpoint?
Yeah, and while that may not seem like a lot, consider that for every additional mile, for every additional amount of pollutant, what you're doing is you're adding millions of metric tons of CO2 to the air. You're adding billions of barrels of additional fuel that will be consumed. And at the end of the day, that all ends up in our lungs. When you have an administration that wants to undo not just California standards, but the nation standards, and roll us back to the old days, it doesn't work in California.
And California for so long has really set the national standards, right? Because we are such a large market for cars. And I know the state is currently fighting with the administration because of another move last fall to revoke California's decades-old waiver that allowed it to set higher emission standards than the federal government. Can you give us an update on that case and how it relates to these latest moves by the Trump administration?
We essentially have about three or four different lawsuits. One of them is to protect California's ability to set our standards. We've had to sue the administration to stop it from trying to backslide on the nation's, entire nation's clean car standards. And we now, just today, we're having to file to intervene in another case, which is coming from not the administration this time. And that lawsuit has been submitted by the Competitive Enterprise Institute, very anti-environment, very pro-industry think tank. They're saying that the Trump administration, which already rolled back our clean air standards for cars, that's still too much, and they want to see the standards be even lower. We don't expect that the Trump administration is going to really defend itself. So we're pushing to intervene and asking the court to let someone come in like California to actually defend the principles and the standards that the EPA can work with to protect our air quality.
In the middle of all this are car makers, and they've been split on which side they will be taking between California and the federal government. Siding with Trump on that previous lawsuit are prominent companies like General Motors and Toyota. What is the concern if, over time, more auto manufacturers back the White House's moves on the issue of air quality standards?
Actually, Libby, I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Trump administration is really concerned that they're going to see more automakers come towards where California and our state coalition is, as we've seen already with a number of players. Honda and other automakers have already come along and worked with California to come up with standards that are far beyond what the Trump administration is proposing. And I don't believe any automaker believes that the future in the 21st century is to use 20th century technology for our automobiles.
And the coalition that's sided with California's ability to set its own air quality standards includes Honda, like you mentioned, Ford, BMW, Volkswagen, some big players in the automobile industry. We're talking with California's Attorney General Javier Becerra. Ultimately, what is the goal here? To preserve California's autonomy in setting its standards? Do you have some standards in mind that you would like to maintain?
Libby, this is 2020, not 1920. For California, it's not that it's fun for us to have to sue the Trump administration. It's not that it's easy to sue the Trump administration. It's that we must, because we can't go back to those bad old days of the way you do business. For those who were around in Southern California in the 1960s and so in the 70s, when pollution would keep your kids from being able to go outside and play in the summers, we just can't go back to those days. And so we must do what we can to clean our air, keep our water clean. We have to protect our environment.
What's the timeline for these cases? Is the November election that is fast approaching going to change your calculation depending on who wins in November?
No, in this particular case, what's going to drive the timeline for these cases are really the courts and how quickly they're able to operate and come back up to speed. We will try to resolve this as quickly as we can, but we're going to be there for the long haul. We'll take this one to the mat because we, as I said, we don't have a choice. We got to keep our air as clean as possible.
Thank you. Attorney General Javier Becerra.
Thanks, Libby.
And finally, this has been quite a week. So if you need to take a mental break from the news, we've got the perfect distractions.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. And Libby, hopefully you found a chance to get outside during the week, since I've got some good ideas on what to do inside. I mean, I've actually found things like hiking trails tend to get a little packed on the weekends.
Yeah, I'm more than happy to zone out on the couch. Don't worry about that. What's up first?
Well, a birthday party, but not just any birthday party. It is the 90th birthday party for activist Dolores Huerta. Tomorrow morning at 11, she's getting a big celebration via Facebook Live. Tons of celebrity guests will be taking part, including Eva Longoria, America Ferrera, Bill and Hillary Clinton, Alicia Keys, and more. The list keeps going. It is a great way to celebrate the labor leader and civil rights icon who fought for farm workers, partnered with Cesar Chavez, and coined the phrase, si se puede. So that one starts on Saturday at 11, and it's free to stream.
And for people who can't make it to a park this weekend, I hear they can at least have a taste of Jurassic Park, right?
Yeah. Well, adults can. Today, starting at 6, Atlas Obscura is hosting a night of dinos and drinking. That's why it's 21 and over. It's called Dino 101, and Dustin Growick of YouTube's Dinosaur Show will have a party while sharing cool facts about them. There will also be things like a bingo board drinking game, a mini scavenger hunt, and more. Now, if you missed today's, it's a series that goes on every Friday until the end of June. I mean, the theme for the one on June 26th is, what do we know about dino sex? I'm sure not many people know about dino sex.
Nada.
And when you go to Dino 101, it is $7 per device that logs in.
Okay, and finally, what have you got for people who need a laugh right now? Because a lot of folks, it's been a very heavy week.
Totally.
A lot of folks need a little bit of lightness, and laughter is the best medicine in many cases. What can you say for people like that?
Okay, so you know how we're all just kind of winging it day by day? How about letting other people do that for you finally and with lower stakes? So today and tomorrow is the LA Digital Comedy Festival presented by We Improv. 60 acts will take part with comedians and improv teams doing their best. Yes, and oh wait, no, you go over Zoom. So many of them have been trained at places like Upright Citizens Brigade. And out of the many things on their schedule, one that stands out to me is called Puns and Hostility. And basically, Libby, if A. Martinez were here today, he would say that performance is probably all about me. Everything is going to be free, but it will be for charity. So donate if you can. And it starts at 4 p.m. today. Now, there's still a bunch more events to go to, whether online or out and about safely. To find out more, head to our site, laist.com. That is laist.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Leo Has a Cat.
And that's KPCC's Leo Duran, the only person I know who weaponizes a pun. Thanks, Leo.
You're welcome.
And hey, final note, if you like what you hear between segments, that's all thanks to Mixmaster Austin Cross, the director of our show, as always. Amazing music, Austin, helps us get through our afternoon with. Thank you for listening to Take Two. I'm Libby Denkman, in for A. Martinez. Stay safe this weekend, and we'll see you on Monday.